May it please the court, my name's Al Gretto, and I'm here on behalf of Jeffrey Culver, the defendant and appellant in this matter. And we come before the court asking the court to answer, I understand it, three questions. The first question concerns administrative searches versus investigatory searches and whether the stalking horse theory or defense is still a viable defense in the state of Delaware. Mr. Culver and I recognize the Knight holding and holdings from the 8th, 3rd, and 9th Circuit. However, it's the case from Judge Jordan down below in the case of Johnson. I think there was some suggestion in that case, as well as the other case, Harris, where the court or where the court Superior Court would then look at the extent law enforcement is involved, and that you shouldn't just act at the request of law enforcement. So the question is Delaware better than some of these other jurisdictions and the rights afforded in the federal system?
Well, where does the Delaware regulation fit into your argument?
There are, I was looking at the case of, I believe it was Harris, and in that case was a guidelines case, and there were some references to the request or the probation and parole office should not act merely at the request of law enforcement. However, in June 5th of 2001, I believe those guidelines were adjusted a little bit, and that I couldn't find that language in the new guidelines, but there are still several instances in the guidelines that caution the department and the officers under the department to be careful how law enforcement is involved so they're not being construed as collaborating with law enforcement. And that would be in the, I believe, 719 and the section on arrest, search, and
so was there or was there not an internal rule, that is probation rule, to the effect that probation officers should not conduct an administrative search solely because they're asked to by law enforcement?
That is my understanding, and I see that rule as cited in
my question is there a rule or is there not?
At this time, I could not find that in 719 as it was adjusted.
Well, as of the time that the events in this case that are critical to the appeal,
there are still other portions of the guidelines that inquire of the department. Law enforcement cannot do the search. Law enforcement is merely there for backup, and so I would suggest to the court that there's still
inferentially a rule.
Yes, sir.
Okay. It's the conviction here, basically resulted from the, arrest warrant by the law enforcement agencies, correct?
No, sir. My understanding of the facts are that law enforcement had an anonymous tip.
No,
general in nature.
Let's talk analytically, not historically. There was a warrant issued for the arrest of this defendant for possessing a weapon.
That comes after an administrative search.
That came after the administrative
that
search.
That we're saying is not necessarily an administrative
But for the administrative search, there would be no legal basis.
That's correct.
For that arrest warrant or for the arrest.
That's correct.
So doesn't the issue boil down to whether there was a basis in law for the probation officers to conduct an administrative search?
Yes.
And the test for that is what? Reasonable suspicion. Your position is that there was no reasonable suspicion.
That's our secondary position. Our primary position, or the first position we're taking, is it's not really an administrative search. It's an investigatory search that they couldn't get what they wanted to find. They couldn't find anything when they unlawfully stopped the vehicle and searched the vehicle.
They meaning the police, not the probation officer.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we're talking about probation here.
Yes, and then what happens is the police call probation.
No, no, wait, we know that. Let's focus on probation and don't conflate what the police did with what probation did. The question, and this is that we're presented with, as I understand your position, and you tell me if we're wrong, is whether the probation officers had a reasonable suspicion that would justify an administrative search of this probationer.
That is the second question that we're positing to the court. Now
that is a question we would have to decide, isn't that correct?
Yes, sir. If you determine that it was it that the stalking horse doctrine does not apply in Delaware, and the issue, it doesn't matter what the purpose of the search is, if it's whether it's, you know, is there reasonable suspicion or not.
Well, if we're applying an ordinary Fourth Amendment analysis to, say, a search by police officers, we don't try and discern their state of mind, what their particular intent was, or whether they believed they had probable cause or not. The issue is whether objectively there's probable cause, correct?
Correct. If there's...
Well, then why shouldn't the same type of objective analysis apply when you have probation officers?
Well, I think probation officers need some latitude to they shouldn't have to run to a court and ask for authority.
I understand that. In reviewing it after the fact, why shouldn't the inquiry not be on the state of mind of the officers? Did they decide they were going to act for the police, as opposed to, was there an objective, reasonable basis to conduct the search, whatever their state of mind might have been?
And what we're trying to say, Your Honor, is that the probation officers, if they're acting at the request of law enforcement.
Well, let's look at the facts of this case and see whether they were acting at the request of law enforcement. The record reflects that your client was on probation.
Yes, sir.
He showed up for two probation interviews and tested positive for drugs.
Yes, sir.
2 days before the search in this case, he didn't show up as scheduled at all. The police called the probation officers and said, you know, we've got concerns about complaints we've received concerning your probationer. So now the probation officers know you've got a client, a probationer, who's tested positive for drugs twice. He didn't show up 2 days ago, and the police are getting these anonymous, uncorroborated calls. Maybe we should see what's going on. Why isn't that a reasonable basis to conduct a search?
I don't recall the no-show. I recall there was a missed curfew, and he called the probation officer 20 minutes later, and I recall hot urines within the first 30 to 37 days of supervision with decreasing levels that suggest it was due to pre-probation use. And so it's Mr. Culver's position and our position that does not give rise to a reasonable suspicion because the levels are coming down, so it doesn't suggest probate use of narcotics or whatever during probation.
Now, is it fair to say that the probation officer would not have taken any action whatsoever in searching Mr. Culver's home had it not been for the police call?
That's correct, sir.
So what is the significance of the police, who did not have probable cause to conduct their own search, calling the probation officer and suggesting facts that the probation officer might use to conduct a probationary administrative search that the police could not conduct themselves?
And what I'm suggesting to the court is that the facts and what law enforcement discovered actually supports that this man was complying with his supervision. They found nothing unlawful at the time. There was an anonymous tip. The tip was general in nature, that there's cars coming to and from the location. Two gentlemen pulled up to the place.
Okay, let's get back to the legal point. We know that we're going nowhere with this under the Third Circuit's pronouncement of the federal law.
That's correct.
So what is there about Delaware law that suggests that the so-called stalking horse concept should not be sanctioned by this court under Delaware law? Where do you go to look for that principle?
or that
doctrine? The general concept is that Delaware affords its citizens more rights, even probationers. This is not the even,
coming from what source?
Dorsey, I believe, is a case that says
Is this a Delaware constitutional elaboration, or is this the rules and regulations that Justice Holland asked you about before, whether it's 7.19 or another? What's the root source of this higher protection that Delaware citizens on probation get that they would not be entitled to under the United States Constitution?
I would suggest that it's the language contained in Harris and Johnson regarding you cannot just act on at the behest of law enforcement or at their request, and the guidelines stating that the two are to remain divorced from each other and what they're doing, although they can collaborate, they do not work arm in arm.
It's not in front of me at the moment because someone removed it from the bench earlier today, to my surprise, but Rule 7.19, as changed, as you suggested, suggests that probation officers are to engage in administrative searches only when it's in furtherance of their role as a probation officer.
Correct.
It doesn't say they can't work with the police or any other strict language like that.
Now, I agree.
If that's the root source of a doctrine that says Delaware probationers get more protection from invasive searches and interference in their privacy rights, such as they may be, than they would have under the U.S. Constitution, is 7.19 the source?
In part, yes, sir. And
then the rest of the source?
And the Delaware Constitution and the cases and decisions that state, such as Dorsey, that the Delaware Constitution and Article 1, Section 6, vis-a-vis the Fourth Amendment and the Federal Constitution, that there's more protections.
Well, but when those cases talk about more protections, they're talking about more protections within the context of a particular factual scenario. I don't know of a case from this court that's ever said that probationers have greater protection from an invasion of their privacy in Delaware than they would have under the Third Circuit's pronouncement of the United States Constitution application in this circuit. But this case, it seems to me, tees it up where we have to answer that question. So what we need to hear from you is what are the doctrinal underpinnings for that, depending on how you want to phrase it, that greater right or that greater bar to interference with the privacy of a Delaware probationer as opposed to a Chester, Pennsylvania probationer?
And the answer is the guidelines suggest that the two entities do not act in unison with each other, and that the purpose is to perform their duties as officers of Department of Corrections.
Well, see, that's where our dilemma is. The way the regulation reads right now is that the probation officers are only to act in furtherance of their duties as a probation officer. So that's why questions from the bench have been directed you to say that if a probation officer has the information that this probation officer had at the time, was it within the scope of his employment and duties in furtherance of his role as a supervising probation officer to go to Culver's home, search it, and seize whatever contraband or illegal property he found there?
And I think there's nothing wrong with law enforcement talking to probation and parole about what's going on, but they had nothing to add here. They had nothing to add. There was no criminal.
But isn't that your problem? That there is evidence that your client had failed drug tests, putting aside the debate as to whether time had something to do with it, and under the search checklist, that gives the probation officers sufficient reason to believe the offender possessed contraband. Aren't we done at that point?
And I say, or suggest to the court, no, and the reason why is if that were the case, probation and parole would have already been wound up to do the administrative search, and that the reason, it's actually, and there's no record on this, but I think the reason why, and there was some testimony as to Ms. Roberts doing an intake to get some levels, right, I think a day or two after this man started probation, to set a benchmark to see if those levels are coming down, and if not, why not?
But didn't one of the state troopers testify that the probation officers were in the process of violating him anyway?
I don't recall that.
Well, you mentioned Dorsey in support of your state constitutional argument, and I just looked at your opening brief. Dorsey's not cited. And to the extent you cite the Delaware Constitution, you cite the section without citing any cases or analysis. And in Ortiz, this court held that if you make a conclusory assertion that state constitutional rights are violated, it's deemed to be waived. How are we going to address your state constitutional argument in light of the fact that you didn't cite Dorsey or any other cases?
I had thought that I had cited in my reply to the state's answer that the Delaware Constitution provided more rights.
Well, you talked about the Delaware Constitution, but what we've held is that you get to pick the issues on appeal. They have to be fully and fairly presented in your opening brief. They can't be presented in the reply brief. They can't be presented in a footnote, and they have to be supported by authority. So my question is, how do we get to your state constitutional argument?
If the court finds that my reply brief was not sufficient, then I suppose we don't.
Well, what about before the Superior Court? Was Dorsey argued before the Superior Court?
No, sir. The time to have done that, I thought, would have been with the trial, and there was a change of judges. One judge heard the suppression, one judge heard the trial, and it was my understanding I could raise the issues that Mr. Culver had with the one judge without putting Judge Silverman in a position.
Now, your motion to suppress did cite the Delaware Constitution, at least an article of it, but there was no further elaboration beyond that and no discussion of the Pennsylvania Constitution or the Delaware constitutional history in any way.
Correct, sir.
Maybe it would be helpful if you would tell us why we should be troubled by the concept that police officers without probable cause that conduct an arrest should be able to call on probation officers solely for the purpose of the theory that they might have a basis for searching without the probable cause that the police did not have. Why should that be troublesome to citizens of Delaware?
Well, where does it stop? I think that the citizens of Delaware should be troubled that law enforcement, what it cannot do it on its own, tries to do through others, and there's cases involving, I think, mostly like co-defendant confessions that say that person's actually an agent of the state, and you can't do that. And
I'm trying to confidential informants all the time to lull people into committing crimes and then arrest them for them. Why should we be troubled by a probation officer who examines the information the police gave him on the basis of his role as a probation officer and then concludes, as my colleagues have pointed out, that we review it on the objective facts, but the probation officer concludes he has a basis for an administrative search. Why isn't that prophylactic enough?
I believe in this case, sir, that the facts that law enforcement had to translate to the probation and parole office actually supported Mr. Culver's position that he was in compliance with the terms.
That sort of brings us to the second point, that though the state argues otherwise, you believe they're not reasonable grounds for the probation officer to conduct the search. Maybe
correct.
You better touch on that before your time runs out.
Correct. And the suggestion is that it was a sudden search. No indication to Mr. Culver that it was coming, and as impromptu it was, everything came up fine, and it was based on information that didn't mean anything. It was an anonymous tip from somebody about cars coming and going from a location.
Are you talking about when the vehicle was stopped or when his residence was searched?
When the vehicle was stopped, when the officer came there to observe what was going on and corroborate this anonymous, very general, nonspecific information from an unknown, unreliable informant, then they go a step further, search the vehicle, bring a canine unit, search, the canine goes through it, and everything's good. At that point, I think anything that law enforcement has to add to the equation is to the benefit of Mr. Culver.
Right. I think the police get high marks for candor in this case. They said they didn't have probable cause to search his car or stop it. They waited for a traffic infraction. then when they were able to pull him over, as you say, they searched the vehicle, had a canine unit help them, found nothing. Then they called the probation officers and reported that to them.
And on that point, our point is simply that the decreasing levels coupled with the impromptu search and passing, that was a test, passed with flying colors. The decreasing levels suggest that he's doing what he's supposed to do in his early point of probation.
The information that the probation officers got from the police under the conditions of that there had been a stop and that contact had happened, wouldn't your client be obliged to report that himself under
yes, sir.
Conditions of probation?
Yes, sir.
Within 24 hours?
Yes, sir.
So does the record reflect if the police made any request of the probation officers concerning a search, or did they simply relay the information?
The testimony, as I recall it, was they were calling just merely to confirm that he was on probation.
We don't know what else was communicated to probation.
No, sir.
But didn't one officer say there was no request to make a search?
I don't recall that specific testimony, but I would reserve the rest of my time to reply.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the state. Your Honor, specifically, Justice Holland, as you pointed out earlier, this Court's holding in Ortiz v. State precludes consideration of the stalking horse claim under the Delaware Constitution at this time. In Ortiz, this Court required the full and fair presentation of the issue, when that is not presented with citations to cases and a history of the Delaware Constitution rather than just a cite to Article 1, Section 6, then that issue is deemed waived on appeal.
Moving to the issue of whether the probation officers had reasonable suspicion that would justify an administrative search of the defendant's home, is it a fair inference from the record? That is, can we treat it as a fact that but for telephone call to probation from law enforcement officers, that there would have been no administrative search?
No, Your Honor, that would not be a fair assessment.
If it's not a fair assessment, that is, if the probation office was going to conduct an administrative search independently on its own in any event, what in the record supports that?
Your Honor, the timing of the various violations leading up to the search.
Well, I mean, was there any testimony from probation saying, oh, no, we were in the process of, we were just about to start an administrative search?
Your Honor, I believe that probation officer Roberts testified that they were certainly after at the three failed urine tests.
Are you suggesting that the probation folks were going to do a search that afternoon?
Not that afternoon.
So you're saying that sometime, it might have been 3 weeks, it might have been 3 months, probation might have gotten around to
it. Yes, Your Honor.
That's a very different answer from the one I heard. I'm thankful
okay.
for clarifying.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting that probation and parole was ready to go and search Mr. Culver's home at that moment without the call from the state police.
So it's fair to say that but for the call, there would have been no administrative search that day.
That day. Yes, Your Honor. Certainly.
But you'd like us to believe that he was in a position on the radar screen, given a cost-benefit analysis in light of the caseload that probation officers have, that based upon a decreasing level of drugs in his system on testing and based on a 20-minute late call-in after missing a curfew, that would have been so significant to them that they clearly would ultimately have conducted an administrative search, absent any other information.
Your Honor, certainly, as Superior Court found, under the totality of the circumstances, the anonymous tip given
I'm sorry. My question, please.
Yes, Your Honor. The testimony was he was on their radar screen for a search.
Can you tell me in the record where that appears?
I'm not able to at my fingertips.
You're confident, as an officer of the court, that you can point that out on the record at some point in the next 24 hours?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe Officer Roberts testified that they were certainly that Mr. Culver was on their radar screen. There was extensive testimony about the conversation.
Well, they on their radar screen. My question is, given these facts and with any common understanding of the caseload that probation officers have and how their attention is directed on a put-out-the-fire type basis day in and day out, are you representing to us that the record reflects that they had him in mind for an administrative search based on the facts at the time of this incident?
Without the tip from the police? No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
You would agree, would you not, that for the administrative search and the fruits of it to be upheld, that apart from the telephone call from the police, probation and parole would have had to have had a reasonable suspicion would have sufficient to warrant an administrative search?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And reasonable suspicion. Your position necessarily is that there was reasonable suspicion.
Yes, Your Honor, under the totality of these circumstances.
Based on what?
Okay, Mr. Culver is on probation. The first drug test is 2 days later. His urine is positive for both cocaine and marijuana. 3 weeks later, he again tests positive for marijuana. And 2 weeks after that, he again tests positive a third time for marijuana. 2 days after that third failed drug test, is there
testimony that that's based on the quantities discovered at each of the tests? Is it consistent with continued use or consistent with prior to probation use diminishing in his bloodstream?
Your Honor, Superior Court made a finding of fact on that basis, and I can cite you to the transcript of the January 24, 2007. If I may just have one moment. That's at page 104. Superior Court recounted the testimony of the probation officer who said that the level of marijuana that was still in there was consistent with ongoing daily use. The fact that he may have been using incredibly heavily before and was using still on a regular basis but not as heavily now, it was still indicative of daily use.
So Superior Court used the term incredibly heavily before, and the probation officer used it as so the
no,
Superior
Your
Court
Honor.
Couldn't make such a factual finding, or are you just being hyperbolic with us now?
Your Honor, I apologize for saying incredibly heavily. That's not what the Superior Court said.
Well, the purpose of characterizing it that way is to get me off the point that there is evidence in the record, and the inference that I've been asked to draw from that is that it's a decreasing involvement with drugs during a period of probation, which, not to confuse the term positive under these factual scenario, but would normally be seen as a probation officer as a positive development, not a negative one, don't you think?
A decreasing level would be a good thing.
It's not one that would alert the probation officer to a need to search his house necessarily, because he's decreasing in his involvement with drugs.
That one fact taken alone, not necessarily. Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, go on.
But this analysis of reasonable suspicion must not be done just based on isolating individual factors, but under the totality of the circumstances.
So what did the police call add to the equation? They called the probation office ostensibly to say, is this gentleman a probationer? And they related the fact that they had an anonymous, uncorroborated tip that led them to stop his car for a traffic violation, and they completely searched this car, and they searched it with a canine unit, and they found nothing. Now, you related the prior facts. What did the call add that would say, well, we'd better go do an administrative search this afternoon? Because you indicated earlier, but for the call, they never would have done the administrative search that afternoon.
Your Honor, the call indicated then that he was still engaged in drug dealing. That was the information that was relayed.
Where in the record is that supported?
This also comes in the testimony of...
Well, that was the suggestion of the anonymous tip,
mm-hmm.
but the search of the car showed absolutely no drugs, even
after
they used the canine dogs. So one would have thought maybe the anonymous uncorroborated tip hadn't really been reliable since it didn't pan out. You say you would reach the opposite conclusion, that he's still involved with drugs, notwithstanding the fact they found nothing in his car after the search with dogs, and we should conduct an administrative search immediately this afternoon.
Your Honor, I believe Superior Court also considered the state trooper's extensive background in drug investigation and considered that also that he had observed the rental car and that he had reason to believe that.
Mr. Smith, I have an extensive experience with the law, but if I can't find a case to support my conclusion, I abandon it. Here the police had, they thought, based on an anonymous tip, a basis to stop, search, find out whether this person was involved with drugs. They found nothing to corroborate it. How does that convert into a reasonable ground for probation to conduct an administrative search?
Your Honor, the state is not suggesting if there were no dirty urines, that anonymous tip on its own would be enough.
Oh, no, I appreciate that, and I didn't phrase the question well. How does that add to the totality of the circumstances in a way that justifies an administrative search based on, quote, reasonable, close quote, grounds?
Your Honor, it's the state's position that even without the tip that the drug tests are sufficient to support reasonable suspicion, but...
Well, what we're trying to do is make a connection between the phone call and the search that day. You've indicated in response to the other justices' questions that this defendant was on the radar, but there might not have been an administrative search for several weeks.
Correct.
But the reason the search took place on this afternoon was because of the call. So the question is, what did the call lend to the totality of the circumstances that led the probation officers to conduct an administrative search immediately?
Your Honor, it added the fact that the report of traffic in and out of the house and the suspicion that he was involved in drug dealing. And again, it's only reasonable suspicion. That's all that it added. It did not add a tremendous amount. That's all that it added.
Is there a difference in a term of art between reasonable suspicion and reasonable grounds, which is the term you used in your brief?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
We know but for the telephone call by the police, there would not have been an administrative search that day. There might have not have been one for 3 months or 6 months or even 12 months. Isn't that fair?
That is certainly fair, Your Honor.
So isn't it the case that the analysis in which the state is asking us to engage is almost otherworldly? That is, it's counterfactual. Even though the probation officers did not consider whatever information they had, apart from the police call, to be enough to warrant a reasonable suspicion, once they made the administrative search, they are lawfully entitled to go back, parse out whatever information they did have, and then argue to a court that it was enough, even though they didn't consider it to be enough as a factual matter to warrant an administrative search. I mean, isn't that what's going on here?
Your Honor, that requires the finding that the official purpose does matter. The official purpose of the search does matter. And if it essentially penalizes probation and parole for receiving information that would in and of itself not be enough for probable cause if an individual were not on probation.
Well, let's back up for a minute. Let's assume hypothetically that the probation officer who authorized the search is on the witness stand, and he's being cross-examined. And the first question is, the information that you're relating to the court now is information that you had the moment before you received the call from the police. Is that correct? Yes. And isn't it also correct that you and your department did not regard that information as sufficient to justify an administrative search at that moment? That's correct. Isn't it fair to say that but for the police call, there would have been no administrative search that day, maybe 3 months later? Yes. Then on what basis are you contending that the search was justified? Well, all of the information that we had before the police called us would have justified a search, even though we didn't believe it at the time. Isn't that what you're asking us to credit?
Your Honor, not that the probation officer didn't believe it at the time, but if you're accepting that because of the volume that they have to prioritize, then getting this tip from the police to make this individual a priority justifies moving him to the front of the line.
Is there testimony to support that speculation?
No, Your Honor.
Now, that makes perfect sense. If the police had called and said, we had probable cause to conduct a search and we found your probationer in possession of 1 ounce of marijuana. But instead, as Justice Holland's question pointed out, the police called and said, we got an anonymous tip that there's people leaving in cars from your probationer's residence, and it suggested to us he may be involved in drugs. We've checked it out. We found nothing. What can you do to help us? How does that add to reasonable grounds in addition to what the probation office already had at that time on this probationer? You're saying the mere relation of the anonymous tip and the information about the anonymous tip and the confirmation that there were cars leaving from time to time by the police, despite the fact they found nothing when they stopped the car with tinted windows, that added to the totality of the circumstances that jump-started an administrative search from somewhere months ahead to this afternoon, and that's reasonable. Is that what you're telling us?
Yes, Your Honor. I would offer some of the language in United States v. Knights in support of that. The Fourth Amendment does not require states to shut their eyes to the likelihood that a probationer is more likely to engage in criminal conduct.
Okay, but Knights predicated on a stalking horse argument, correct? Mm-hmm. Let's forget about the stalking horse argument. What about under 7.19 or any other rules under promulgated pursuant to a Delaware statute that tells probation how it's probation officers, how they are to conduct themselves in supervising probationers? And 7.19 in particular seems to focus on probation acting only to carry out probation officers' responsibilities of supervision. It doesn't mention law enforcement officers. It doesn't say this is the anti-stalking horse regulation or anything like that. But is that of any significance?
Your Honor, the state would submit after Knights it is not. That the probation regulations were certainly of significance under pre-Knights law. Griffith v. Wisconsin. That created and oftentimes reliance on whether a probation search was compliant with probation regulations to determine whether it was in fact reasonable. And simply, yes, that is one way to determine whether a search would be reasonable, to look at the regulations themselves. But
is it to determine whether it should be conducted at all or not? Not under any constitutional theory, application, or doctrine, but simply under probation officers, these are the rules and regulations that under which you conduct yourselves. And Delaware has made a statement that you don't do searches unless it's consistent with your actions necessary to properly supervise your probationer, which by inference might exclude being used by the police to conduct a search that the police could not conduct in their own right. Forget about constitutional doctrine. Is this a statement of Delaware state social policy that we have a statute that authorizes the promulgation of rules and regulations under which probation officers are to conduct themselves. And 7.19 says, by any fair reading of it, that it doesn't include you being used by the police to do what the police cannot do on their own.
Your Honor, certainly state regs are a reflection of the policy of, in this case, the Department of Correction. That's absolutely a fair statement. That said, the regs certainly follow case law. They're not going to get out ahead of it. So what the regs are today, yes, they are what they are. They can be changed. What is in the regulation for a probation checklist should not determine constitutional standards for whether a search was supported by reasonable suspicion.
But there has to be substantial compliance with the regulations, does there not, under case law?
Your Honor, substantial compliance with the checklist, that is one way to demonstrate that a search was supported by reasonable suspicion. But that is not the only way. If I may, I'm sorry.
Can you help me on this point as well? On Regulation 7.19, is there a full copy of that in the record that we have? Or do we have to look elsewhere for that?
Your Honor, the copy that's in there right now.
The one in effect at the time of this search.
In effect at the time of the search. I'm not 100% positive that it's a complete copy. I cannot represent that to the court right now. I'm not suggesting that it is not, but I can't make that representation right now.
Well, just one other question. Was there direct testimony on the point of whether or not there was a request by the police for the probation officers to conduct this search? Was there direct testimony on that?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that there was. I believe the testimony was Captain Ogden calling to Pat Cronin, supervisor, and advising him and leaving it at that. That's my understanding of the testimony. Obviously, there was no discussion about the final issuance. Therefore, I don't believe it's appropriate for me to respond to that unless the court has specific questions regarding the statement made acknowledging the ownership of the gun.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Albert Gretto again, in reply. With respect to the reasonable suspicion angle and the balancing act that gets done, I would suggest that we start off with the fulcrum at zero and the facts that the levels are coming down, tip in Culver's favor, the facts that there's an impromptu search or test to see if the man's complying, that actually tilts the scale even more in Mr. Culver's favor. They'll miss curfew by 20 minutes, sends the balancing act the other way a tad, and would still suggest that when you take all things considered, that balancing act tips in favor of Mr. Culver in terms of this totality of the circumstances and reasonable suspicion. And I believe 7.19 I included in the appendix to my opening.
And I just saw in the transcript, you agree that this question was asked I believe it was Cronin, at any time did the Delaware State Police ask you to conduct a search of the defendant's residence? Answer, no, they did not. Was there anything to contradict that?
I don't know how one could contradict that. I believe that's what he responded, and if the court finds that was truthful and accurate statement, but I would suggest to you that, and the that this man was not on the radar. This man, as I recall the record, Mr. Cronin had to get familiar with the man in his file. There was nothing to suggest that Cronin knew of the man, that Ms. Roberts spoke with Mr. Cronin about this man. This man was in the very beginning of things, and they were figuring out what they had, and everything was suggesting that he was doing well on supervision.
What's his current status? Is he incarcerated?
Yes, sir.
Is it for this offense, or is it for a violation of probation, or both?
Both, sir. He's incarcerated on I believe he got a year back on the VOP, and then Judge Silverman gave him the minimum, which was very gracious of him.
I'm trying to decide whether this case merits quick or are usually reasonably rapid consideration.
1 year of on the VOP from the date of this, the suppression / VOP hearing, and 3 years from the sentencing date of the trial. I think we're still.
Thank you very much. I got it. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.